Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the University Professors Program as part of the Literary Translation Seminars. Speaking will be Peter Fallon, founder of the Gallery Press Ireland. Mr. Fallon's lecture is titled Georgics, Render and Surrender, From Virgil's Then to Our Now. We begin with an introduction by University Professor Rosanna Warren.
Welcome. 2005 was an extraordinary year for the Georgics, which Virgil completed in 30 BCE. Three powerful translations appeared, each a deep and singular reading of Virgil's Poem of the Earth. And it is a time in the life of Homo sapiens on this planet, I think, when we most need intelligent translations of this Poem of the Earth. Janet Lemke's version, in rough hexameters, published by Yale, hews the closest to the Latin prosody and syntax of these three. And her diction is at once Latin and quite precise in veterinary terms. Here, I just want you to hear Lemke at the conclusion of the poem describing the regeneration of Aristaeus's bees from the slaughtered bull carcasses. Here's Lemke at the end of the fourth Georgic. 9 days later, when dawn brings in the sunrise, he pays his dues to Orpheus and revisits the grove. Here, a sudden omen, plain to see, almost incredible to tell, out of the putrefying bovine guts, out of the bellies and burst sides, bees buzzing, swarming, then streaming upward in huge clouds till they join in a tree top and hang in a great ball from a bending branch. That's Lemke. David Ferry's Georgics, published by Farrar Straus, talk American. He has made a visionary agricultural mythological poem in the firm pentameters and clear demotic speech learned somewhat from Robert Frost, somewhat from years of his own practice as a magnificent poet. I want to read you Ferry's conclusion of the fourth Georgic. But there was a sudden, a marvelous event, a prodigy, miraculous to tell. Everywhere in the bellies of the victims, bees buzzing in the fermenting viscera and bursting forth from the ruptured sides in swarms that drift along like enormous clouds in the sky and come together high in the top of a tree and hang in clusters from the swaying branches. So that's Ferry. Peter Fallon, our guest today, has made his own exuberant, idiomatic, playful, and tragic Irish hymn to the earth from the Georgics. This translation of Fallon's was first published by the Gallery Press and now is published by Oxford University Press. His hexameters bound and rollick. He is so deeply at home in this poem. He can have his way with it in a breezy, affectionate authority. And here is how he winds up the scene of the regenerating bees. And there they met a miracle and looked it in the face. From those cattle's decomposing flesh, the hum of bees bubbling first, then boiling over, and trailing giant veils into the trees, they hung like grapes in bunches from the swaying branches. Fallon, himself a fine poet in his own right with six volumes to his name, is also importantly for this work, his Georgics, a farmer. He knows in his own hands and back and knees the hard and reverent labor the earth demands in order to stay fertile. It's also hard labor to keep human communities at peace, which is also not irrelevant to our world today. Peter Fallon has also been a tireless and generous cultivator of the work of others, partly in his work as publisher with the Gallery Press, partly in his work as anthologist and editor. For instance, he edited with Derek Mahon the Penguin Book of Contemporary Irish Poetry, a really wonderful, wonderful collection. He received the 1993 O'Shaughnessy Poetry Award from the Irish American Cultural Institute. And I want to welcome him here with his own words from his poem, Winter Work, from this volume of his poems, Winter Work. This is the last two stanzas. I warm to winter work, its rituals and routines, and find, indoors and out, a deal of pleasure, alone or going out to work with neighbors. a methyl still. All I approve persists, is here, at home. I think it exquisite to stand in the yard, my feet on the ground, in cow shit and horse shit and sheep shit. Welcome.
She said it, I didn't. This is about as complicated a thing as ever happens in Ireland. You try to distribute some things and they end up with one person. Can we pass these out, please? Good afternoon, and thank you, Rosanna. I suspect several of you here today will know or be able to guess how much easier it is to give a poetry reading than to give a talk about a poem. I know I do. You have the poems, you make a selection, you remember a necessary gloss or think of an introduction, you settle in to feel at home in a version of the world you have made or remade. You can do that because you have come to learn that you are most yourself in your own poems. I appreciate greatly, deeply, the invitation to address this illustrious seminar. I am grateful, too, for the welcome from Rosanna, and I am quietly terrified. I can't help but feel that I'm out of my depth, that I'll be found out. I am not an academic. I am not, truth to tell, a classicist. But I have devoted the greater part of my life to poetry, to my own attempts to write poems, where it all began, and, as you've heard, to other people's poetry as an editor and publisher of now some hundreds of books. And for several years recently, I dedicated part of every day to a single poem by another poet in another language, a long-dead poet in what's called a dead language. It's my hope to talk about how this poem came into my life when I was a boy at a boarding school, how 3.5 decades later, after first resisting its siren calls, I found myself, by an act of close reading, welcoming it closer into my life, and how, when I started to engage with it through translation, I hoped to help it come to life in a new way and in my own language. I should like, in short, to report a personal account of a personal encounter with Virgil's beautiful poem, The Georgics. I'll hope, too, to speak about the poem itself, certain problems with it, and about translation in more general ways. Let me begin, please, near my beginnings and describe something of my own experiences with language. Please understand, I want to presume nothing. My first language was German. Both my parents were Irish, and my father, an officer in the British Army, was stationed in Germany with the Rhine Troops, a peacekeeping force after World War II. By the time we made our permanent move home to Ireland, when I was 6, I'd learned English too. Almost from the beginning, I'd found, unselfconsciously, that there were different ways of saying something. At school in Kells in County Meath in the Irish Midlands, near where we lived on my uncle's farm, I started then to learn Irish. 4 or 5 years afterwards, at boarding school, I started French and Latin. At the time I was first introduced to passages from the Georgics, my home life and my dream life centered on that farm near Carnaross, a couple of miles from Kells. I couldn't have guessed then that my everyday experiences of land work and livestock and my read about in an old poem, encounters, echoes, and reminders would so neatly coalesce. My knowledge that there were different ways of saying things intensified, I'm sure, by the time I reached university in Dublin, where at Trinity College I studied Anglo-Saxon and began to publish poems and poems of my own. I'd already begun, too, to be the publisher of two of my lectures, as if that would help me. But that's another story. Different ways of saying things. These were, in effect, on my doorstep from the start. And then I learned that there are also different ways of seeing things. And if one of these examples wasn't exactly on the doorstep, it was almost next door. Let me digress. We had a neighbor, one Tom Farley, for whom language was anathema. He avoided it as if it were a burden, a nuisance, an unnecessity. He was famous for his shyness of it and simply never spoke. Until, that is, those occasions for which he also had a kind of local fame, those days when what we called his strong weakness overcame him, and he'd take a drink, and then another, and another. And it happened that one evening he was walking on the road in the opposite direction of our local parish priest, a Monsignor no less, and a stern and critical man. And as these fellows approached each other, Tom was heard to say, "Grand evening, Father," a bad sign. And then something along the lines of, "That's powerful weather, and there's a brave stretch in the evening, Father," a worse sign, to which our curate replied with some scorn, "Drunk again, Thomas." And Tom replied, "I can see that, Father, but you'll be all right in the morning." Ways of saying, ways of seeing poetry. Before I graduated from college, I was gravitating from Dublin back to the countryside. In the early 1970s, I happened on an old house, part of a large estate, in Loch Crewe, in North Meath, a hen's race from the home place, where first I'd come to consciousness. Here I re-entered a world of farming, helping first with a neighbour's large flock and subsequently, in a much smaller scale, raising sheep and cattle of my own. And to live in this community, I'd to relearn or remember the language which surrounded me when I was a boy. I used again a vocabulary, idiom, and set of references that belonged to a particular locality, and these were in English. But by this time, I'd been schooled in another English, of literature and what we call the academy. On the one hand, there was a language that I'd inherited or absorbed through that osmosis of childhood attention that I simply knew. On the other hand, there was a language to which I'd been attracted, which I'd studied, and that I'd learned. I had become essentially bilingual in one language. Inevitably, my transformation and translocation of Virgil's poem drew on both stores of linguistic resources, translation and poetry. A poem itself is a translation of something experienced or imagined through the act of composition. To read a poem is further to translate it, and to attempt to translate one poem involves a way of reading it with the hope of constructing or creating another. The success of that act of reading depends on an affinity between one author and another, one world and another, and such success is the fruit of various languages, the original authors and the translators, and if it's a translation from the past, the languages of both ages and both authors' cultures. Ideally, I think, the translation of a poem by a poet displays attributes, virtues, and values consonant with the kind of poems the translating poet composes him or herself. My partiality towards the Georgics hinged on more than the fact that, as Elaine Phantom notes in her introduction to a new edition, Virgil's home in North Italy, in Cisalpine Gaul or Lombardy, had been, until a century before his birth, inhabited by Celtic tribes. I loved the poetry of this hymn to peace and people, Virgil's plea for the restoration of traditions and his re-establishment and reiteration of the essential worth of agricultural life, accorded with my own concerns at that time in County Meath. While my country struggled to discover new ways to proceed in the aftermath of what we called the Troubles in our north, Virgil's delineation of the griefs and glories of a land in which people tried to found their lives, their new ways of life, while their days were adumbrated by a recent civil war, became a touchstone. I cherished both the moral force of the poem and the way Virgil infused descriptions of a way of life with prescriptions of a way to live. Let me please ask that we begin not at the beginning, but before the beginning, and look at two pieces of writing separate from the Georgias, one of them not even by Virgil, but by a different anonymous author. You have your sheets, and I mean a 10th century Irish celebration commonly presented as summer, or summer has come, or something like that. Let's consider these prose and verse renditions by Irish scholars, and then a version by a contemporary poet, Seamus Heaney. James Carney translates in prose. Noble and perfect summer has come, that makes the dark wood bend, the swift, slender stag leaps, that makes smooth the path of seals. The cuckoo sings a sweet, smooth song that brings easy, gentle sleep. The birds leap to the quiet hill, and the swift grey stags make a leap. Heat has seized the shelter of the dare. There is a fine, harmonious cry of dog packs. The strand smiles, fair land that is wont to anger the swift sea. There is a subdued rustle in the wild top of the stout, dark, black oak grove. Sleek, well-bred herds of horses run that are wont to find shelter in Kilcoon. Every plant bursts out in green. The bush in the green oak wood is full of leaves. Summer has come, winter has gone. Twisted hollies wound the hound. The blackbird, inheritor of the thorny wood, sings a bold song. The fierce cliffed sea sleeps. The speckled salmon leaps. The sun smiles over every land. The edge will cleave, it will strike the bark. Hounds cry out, stags gather, ravens increase, summer has come. And in the neighboring version by Kuno Meyer, Summer Has Come, in his verses, he includes almost all of these details. There is an abundance of details, a sense of literal fidelity to an elaborate record, even the appropriation by one of these authors of another's line. Both have twisted hollies wound the hound. With that line's alliteration and off-rhyme, but it's in one simple phrase, one moment, that I want to look at especially. In Seamus Heaney's sprightly lyric, much of the particular detail is forfeit, and there is much that he introduces. Summer. Early summer, loveliest season. The world has been coloured in. While daylight lasts on the horizon, sudden, throaty blackbirds sing. The dusty coloured cuckoo cuckoos. Welcome summer is what he says. Winter's unimaginable. The woods a wicker wood of boughs. Summer means the river's shallow. Thirsty horses nose the pools. Long heather spreads out on bog pillows. White bog cotton droops in bloom. Swallows swerve and flicker up. Music starts behind the mountain. There's moss and a lost growth underfoot. Spongy marchland glugs and stutters. Bog banks shine like raven's wings. The cuckoo keeps on calling welcome. The speckled fish jumps and the strong, swift warrior is up and running. A little jumpy, chirpy fellow hits the highest note there is. The lark sings out his clear tidings. Summer, shimmer, perfect days. Seamus introduces a lark, swallows, bog cotton, which aren't in the original Irish, but they are part and parcel of the subject of the poem. And the phrase I want to focus on is, in Kearney, the cuckoo sings a sweet, smooth song. In Cunamara, the cuckoo sings gentle music. And in Heaney, there's the risk of pure magic. The cuckoo cuckoos. What could be simpler? A plain repetition, delightfully enacting the sound and presenting the image. He has accomplished that leap from what he has described in a review of the Georgics as being from lexical correctness to poetical rightness. And I venture that this could only be the work of a poet. Which of these is the right translation? Easy. None. A translation or version can't be right. It isn't math with a proper solution. It can only be less wrong. And if Seamus's take on the work perhaps of an ancient monk illuminating manuscripts is, more than the others are, a new music, it is one which still honours the spirit and impulse of the original. Let me pause further to look at what might be the best known words that Virgil composed, the opening of his greatest poem. They're not on your sheet, but you probably know them. What can these ever be again, these three words, but a loud knock on the door of a fabled work, with interested readers all ears to learn how a new translator might venture to answer? I mean, of course, the opening not of the Georgics, but of the Aeneid. Arma virumque cano. Dryden nailed them in 1697. Arms and the man I sing. And set a near impossible bar for more recent distinguished translators. Cecil Day Lewis. I tell about war and the hero. Robert Fitzgerald. I sing of warfare and a man at war. Alan Mendelbaum. I sing of arms and of a man. And then there's one I love for its awful flatness. Could there be anything much less inviting than the English poet's C.H. Sisson's opening? This poem is about battles and the man. Clunk. Robert Fagles, in his new translation, begins, "Wars and a man I sing," and makes the hero of the epic with that indefinite article an everyman, albeit one who has a divine parent. Whichever of these approaches is, well, least wrong, one thing is apparent at once. Our language, English, needs more words than Latin. Our work is bound to be longer, unless there is some kind of Beckettian parlor game somewhere that could propose simply three English words to convey Virgil's bold flourish. But I don't know that game, and I don't think I'd like to play it. I resisted my first impulses to translate the Georgics. There was no push or pull from outside, no commission, though people in Ireland who know my poems have since said that it was there waiting for me all along. There was nothing like that moment, for instance, that I believe involved Irving Berlin, or it might have been Sami Khan, who was interviewed once about his songwriting and was asked which came first, the words or the music, and he said, the phone call. I resisted because I thought it was beyond me. I doubted my Latin. I wondered about my knowledge of the ancient world. Yes, I knew about the husbandry of sheep and cattle and horses. I knew a bit about bees. But our climate in Ireland and land that grew olives and vines seemed far from each other. And then I remembered Coleridge's observation that not all of a long poem is poetry. And I wondered if I might excerpt some of the more immediately appealing passages, those self-contained pieces that I found I had a particular empathy with. I felt close to and at home in a passage such as this. If a crop of wool be your concern, nip them in the bud, those burrs and thistles. Steer clear of pastures in too good a heart, and from the start select a flock with spotless fleeces. As for the ram, however white his wool, if he's as much as one black spot beneath the crown of his moist mouth, cast him aside. That speck will smudge the pureness of his progeny. You'll find another soon enough. There's a world of them to choose from. At home, yes, and familiar with this kind of building of a choice flock. And pleased, too, to find that it took stockmen in England until the 1700s to learn the truth of what Virgil knew more than 17 centuries before, that one black spot could smudge or spoil the pureness of the progeny and of an entire flock. This was a part of my own world, but what follows the documentary accuracy of those lines in Virgil was part of another seductive, seducing store and imagining. And so it was, if truth were told, that Pan of Arcadia wooed you the moon, and by such immaculate designs he drew you to the secret places of the wood, and you did not resist his call. This wasn't really a part of my own world, but it could enlarge it in ways that appealed to me. That notion I had that I might cherry-pick gave way quickly to a realization that I'd need to make myself familiar with the context of any excerpts and that I would, in fact, have to tackle the whole poem, whether I'd ever publish all or indeed any of it. I'd begun to see it as a mosaic with bright, eye-catching tesserae of seemingly self-contained passages set into the wider wall of what might have looked like a duller expanse. Or I'd begun to see the poem as a great stone wall with the key and coin stones, the cross ties and cappings, all we notice first, no more important ultimately than the fill and rubble, lime and mortar, those punctuations between large stones and rocks, essential to its wholeness. If it was only for myself, and with perhaps that possibility in mind or at the back of the mind, that a couple or three dozen very short extracts might sometime lend themselves to publication, I knew I'd have to subject the poem to the translator's microscope. I still wasn't fully aware of the poem's astonishing integrity, its organic shape. That would only confirm itself bit by bit. And that's what I'd been looking at, bits. And then I found that these were pieces and that they fit. But how, I wondered, could I get up and running with the opening line? Yes, I looked at other versions, and it's only proper to declare at this stage that although I heard while I was engaged with my undertaking that the distinguished author, poet, and scholar David Ferry, who's here, was also engaged in work on a renewal of the poem. His appeared, I think, about a year after mine, and I haven't read it. I was warned he'd be here to keep an eye on me, and I've looked forward to meeting him. His Georgics is a pleasure I've been saving. One of these translations you have on your sheets is the stately Victorian prose of a man called Conington from 1882. He has, for his poem's opening clause and question, quid faciet laetas segetes, what makes a cornfield smile. While L.P. Wilkinson, whose critical survey, The Georgics of Virgil, I trusted and heeded greatly, has what makes the corn crops glad. While an earlier Irish poet, Cecil Day Lewis, 60 more years ago, when the rations and wants and shortcomings of the Second World War added a practical urgency to the poem's advocacy of a self-sufficient life, has, and I have it here, what makes the cornfields happy. All of these seem perfectly fine, but none was mine. I'll confess, too, that I found a recently published translation by a young doctoral graduate from which I took great heart because, forgive me for this unkindness, I thought it was awful. And I also thought, whatever happens, mine shouldn't be the worst translation I've ever seen. Hers begins, How to Make Fields Fertile. I stumbled around combinations like any of these, I suppose. And then I was happy at first, that is, to find an idea and image in a poem I'd written some years before. A poem, as it happens, about settlement in a new world and a new set of conditions. The world, as it happens, of New England after its Indian and French wars. In a poem called The Deerfield Series, Strength of Heart, a bicentennial offering to the Academy west of here that 10 years ago I gave when I lived there as poet in residence, I included these lines. They hunted and gathered. Then, with fire, axe, plow, and hoe, they tickled the soil. Three sisters laughed. Corns, beans, and squash. And savoring a connection, the sense that something was emerging out of my own work, something on the record already, I adopted this for my opening to what tickled the corn to laugh in rows, and felt a kick start. I felt I was on my way. And if you'll forgive me further, it seems this line, whatever pulse there was to it, the interpretation or angle of it, took a number of people's fancy. They seemed to like it, and I've to admit, I did too. But there was always something about it which troubled me, something I probably didn't want to face. It was that in rows, what tickled the corn to laugh in rows. I thought of contemporary cornfields, the regimented order that grew from the equal spacing of openings in the seed box. And I thought back to my first sight of men sowing and knew these were part of a line that stretched back to Virgil's time as they broadcast seed from what we call a bag apron with arcs of spread seed and subsequent growth, but not with rows. What tickled the corn, I changed sometime later. That line to read, what tickled the corn to laugh in rows, appeared in journals and anthology, the first edition, and was quoted in reviews. It might have struck me as a small sacrilege, but I recast the line for the work's reissue. I don't know if anyone noticed, but I rest easier with what's now on the record. What tickles the corn to laugh out loud? And by what star to steer the plough? And how to train the vine to elms? Good management of flocks and herds, the expertise bees need to thrive, my lord, my sinas, such are the makings of the song I take upon myself to sing. I've mentioned already the various languages I or any translator brought or would bring to bear on this kind of undertaking. Among and between all of us, and all of those we hope for a balancing act, a search for a steadiness, an equilibrium. Let me cite a couple of specific examples. In my translation, I've used the word elders, not for seniors or wise men of a tribe, but for the milk-filled bags of goats and cows. And when I received a set of proofs from Oxford, there was beside this a surprisingly curt, I think this must be a typo for udders. Well, no, it's not. When I was a boy, one of the cows we milked at first and last light comported herself with a certain dignity between the grand name O'Growney's Crooked Elder. We'd bought her from a man called O'Growney, and her bag was not straight. What else could she have been called? I didn't know at that time the word udder, and when I heard it first, it struck me as arch, something akin to mammary tract. But what the reader could assume my elder meant, but that the reader could assume my elder meant udder seemed fine to me. But if it's milk you're after, handpick and put before the herd in pens plenty of lucerne and clover and salted grass, for the minerals will whet their thirst and swell their elders and flavour what they yield with a briny taste. The milk you strip by dawn or daylight, you'll curdle in the night, and what you draw at dusk or dark, you'll cart away in wicker work when the shepherd goes to town, or sprinkle with a pinch of salt and set aside for winter use. Earlier, the same proofreader, who, I should say, made all kinds of insightful observations, clearly balked at the precise varieties of language I was trying to accommodate. She was most definitely monolingual in English, employing, encouraging, insisting on the standards of Oxford. And she added a note about a line in book one. Cot, she wrote, seems an extremely odd translation for limbum. And well, it might be. But cot is a light-skinned boat, a sort of local curragh or curricle, distinctive to the River Boyne, which flows through my home, County Meath, and therefore attractive to me, of course, and fitting too in my imagination, better in the sense of its delicate lightness than more conventional translations of limbus as a pinnace or cutter. I've seen with my own eyes plantsmen steeping seeds before they set them down, drenching them in saltpeter and the dregs of olive oil, so that their deceiving pods would grow a greater yield, one that might amount to something over a low flame. And I have seen long tried and tested crops begin to fail, where no one took the time each year to sort and save the finest grain seed by seed. For that's the way it is. World forces all things to the bad, to founder and to fall, just as a paddler in his cot, struggling to make headway up a river, if he lets up a minute, will find himself rushed headlong back between the banks. I'd like to think that if you don't or didn't know the word cot, you'd still be able to picture that oarsman's loss of control in the rush against the river's flow when he stops paddling. But let me try to suggest simpler intrinsic difficulties. There's a phrase in book one, the opening of line 43, vere novo. How could that cause trouble? How could anyone become tied up in a knot like that? Ver, veris, spring, vernal, novus, new, young, fresh, novel. I'd happen on a combination of these that seemed apt and pleasing, and then remember or discovered that I'd use one or other part of it, spring, early, new, somewhere nearby, in a way that ruled it out. Try it. Consider all the ways you could translate those two plain words. That's your assignment from me. And then place them so they'll hold their own in the pattern of 2,200 other lines. For that moment in the year, a season of western breezes announcing the time to plough Wilkinson offers in early spring. De Lewis, early spring. Connington, in the dawn of spring. And my friend, the one I thought I'd better, whatever I'd do, simply took the phrase out of the poem and made it in heading, New Spring, inspired. I thought it would best me for ages, then I stole from Shakespeare. This was one kind of problem, though the solution to it didn't hide in my not knowing what the phrase meant. There are in the poem references that I still don't understand. In book 4, line 48, the instruction not to roast red crabs. I don't know and haven't been able to deduce a meaning for this. Perhaps I'll get help here. Your other assignment. And there's the problem of, by translating faithfully, of promoting an error. I resisted the temptation to correct passages about which I think Virgil was mistaken. His claim that bees take on pebbles as ballast to ground their flights in Book 4. His description of a certain quality of soil as ideal in Book 2. I turned a blind eye to his apparent contradictions about the advantages of letting land lie fallow or unused. For some, there's another inherent problem regarding the core of Book 4, and the belief in the ancient world that at the heart of a hive and the society of bees, Virgil's emblem for a good social order and organization was not a queen, but a king. Throughout, the word rex appears, and the belief that the king bee was in fact female wasn't fully established until Charles Butler published his Female Monarchy more than 1,600 years after Virgil, when Shakespeare was at work on his plays. But I was happy to allow subservience to a queen. Why not, I thought. For many of us, the poem raises even more general questions. Now, at an anti-imperial moment in history, how do we respond to the glorification of empire? How, in a largely secularized West, do we view a people devoted to gods? And how do we accommodate Virgil's attitude to the force of furor and any sexual charge or ardor? I was shocked recently to find that I was simply wrong in one of my final lines, and there's no clue in my notes or drafts to explain this. Somehow a misreading crept in. I don't know how or why, and neither I nor any of my readers picked up on it. I need to correct it still. My work's not finished. I started that work thinking The Georgics is a great poem. I came to its end knowing it is. I believe it's the most beautiful poem of its age, and part of the wonder of it is this, that however you describe it, as manual, treatise, social history, and study, as gazetteer, treatise, or tutorial, as a didactic or narrative poem, you shortchange it. Any such description is inadequate. So what was the aim of my approach and engagement? First, to study and read the poem. Secondly, I dare say, to offer a version to my country, one that honored the original, that said, read this. Some years ago, nearly 30 years ago, the playwright Brian Friel, whom we revere, and that fine actor Stephen Ray joined forces to form a company they called Field Day. And its purpose was to present new work, including work that we now recognize as masterpieces of, I dare say, world literature. Their first production was Brian Friel's Translations. And this was presented in Derry in the north of Ireland, 1980, politically charged time, and toured small towns in the north of Ireland. And that was their hope and intention and brief. And they said at one point, having enlisted other people to the board, people like Seamus Heaney, Seamus Dean, Davy Hammond, Tom Paulin, and ultimately Tom Kilroy, they said that they were talking to each other. They were part of a conversation at a local level and said, but if the world wanted to listen, to eavesdrop, or to overhear, that was just fine. And in some way, I felt close to that impulse with my attempt to translate a poem that had engaged my interest that might be of interest to people within Ireland. Asked for a title for this presentation, the words render and surrender were occupying me. Render as in provide a service, give help, submit or present for inspection, hand over, or deliver, especially a judgment, albeit in this case a silent one. And I hope, in artistic terms, to present or depict, in musical terms, to perform a piece, in culinary terms, to melt down, to clarify, and I'm prepared to believe this, I'm only told it, in computer land, a planet about which I know next to nothing, I can't even type, the process of outlining an image using color and shading to make it solid, to make it three-dimensional. And surrender, remember my first resistance, to cease, to withstand, to submit, and also to abandon oneself to or give in to. Render or surrender, neither, but both. Virgil's then and our now, how far apart, in fact, are they? What Day Lewis, in a prefatory poem called A Song in Time of War About the Arts of Peace, seemed as necessary to me now as ever. And while I never looked for what so many seemed to need to find, that is, relevance, I'm happy to let things be. How chilling it was in the spring of 2003 to be working on the end of book one, while world leaders refused the patience and prudence implicit in the UN resolution 1441 and rushed eastwards to war. A war, remember, they said, would last a week. Let me read some excerpts from the end of book one. These people who paid heed to weather, who were aware of its instructions. In short, whatever evening's bringing on, whence winds propel fair weather clouds, and what wet southerlies portend, the sun will advance warning signs. Who dare to question the sun's word? For it is he once more who forestalls troubles, hidden but at hand, of conflicts festering out of sight. And it was he who felt for Rome, that time that Caesar fell, and veiled his gleaming head in gloom, so dark the infidels began to fear that night might last forever. The skies of Germany resounded with the din of war. Weird stirrings caused the Alps to tremble. What's more, in quiet groves a voice was heard by many peoples, a monstrous voice, and pallid spectres loomed through the dead of night, and, dare I say it, cattle spoke. The rivers ground to a halt. Gaping holes appeared, and in the sanctuary carved ivories began to weep the tears of mourning and bronzes to perspire. The Po, King River, swept away in raging rushes across the open plains, whole plantations, cattle and their stalls swept all away. That was a time when entrails, carefully scrutinized, showed nothing but the worst, and wellsprings spouted blood all day, and hill towns howled all night with wolves. Nothing surer than the time will come when in those fields a farmer ploughing will unearth rough and rusted javelins and hear his heavy hoe echo on the sides of empty helmets and stare in open-eyed amazement at the bones of heroes he's just happened on. Stand back. Don't block the way of this young one who comes to save a world in ruins. For right and wrong are mixed up here. There's so much warring everywhere. Evil has so many faces, and there is no regard for the labors of the plow. Bereft of farmers, fields have run to a riot of weeds. Look here. The East is up in arms. Look there. Hostilities in Germany. Neighboring cities renege on what they pledged and launch attacks. The whole world's at loggerheads. A blasphemous battle, as when, right from the ready, steady, go, chariots quicken on a track, until the driver hasn't a hope of holding the reins, and he's carried away by a team that pays heed to nothing, wildly away, and no control. Yeats said a civilization is a struggle to keep self-control. But when I think about these undertakings and endeavors which interest all of us here this evening, I think of José Saramago's observation that the author, with his or her language, creates a national literature. World literature, he says, on the other hand, is created by translators. It's to that that we may contribute. It's for that that I'm grateful. Thank you very much.
Peter Fallon, founder of the Gallery Press Ireland. Mr. Fallon's lecture was presented by the University Professors Program and titled Georgics, Render and Surrender, From Virgil's Then to Our Now. Introducing Mr. Fallon was University Professor Rosanna Warren. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by George Hicks and Tim Skog. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.